A look at 1 year of COVID-19 through the eyes of people all over the world. It's Friday, April 23rd, and this is In the Moment. I'm Steve Zwemke, filling in for Lori Walsh. On today's show, The Virus That Shook the World. It's a new two-night Frontline documentary that follows the coronavirus, talking with people from different cultures, different parts of the world, and different privilege. Director James Blumel joins us in about 20 minutes. Richard Tubols reports on a new teen center that's providing teens with the opportunity to experience life outside the reservation. We'll hear about this weekend's Levitt in Your Living Room featuring the Gullah Band Ranky Tanky. In Chuck Parkinson's You and Your Democracy, we hear about the three branches of government, and in a special feature during our moment, our April of Talking Guns, In the Moment host Lori Walsh is down with Chris Loffery. The news is next on SDPB.
With SDPB News, I'm John Wynn. Construction will start soon in Rapid City for a new corporate headquarters. It's a company that hopes to employ about 200 people by 2026. Governor Kristi Noem attended the groundbreaking and says she hopes it points to South Dakota's unique position in the tech industry. SDPB's Lee Strubinger reports.
Property Meld provides maintenance solutions for around 600 property management companies across the United States and Canada. Its new building will turn a vacant lot in downtown Rapid City into a two-story, 14,000-square-foot facility. Ray Hespin is the co-founder and CEO of the company. He's also a South Dakota School of Mines alum. He says Rapid City has always struck him as the place to start a business.
We've learned that people want to work somewhere where they want to live. I think if anything, the pandemic showed us that. Rapid City has always been a place where people want to live. So we just had to create the opportunity that says, let's create a place to work in the place you want to live. And so for us, this made a lot of sense because we were just aligning wants and needs.
Hespin says Property Meld can support companies anywhere in the country. While geography isn't important, it is advantageous to Rapid City, which is 4 to 5 hours away from many major metro areas. Governor Kristi Noem says technology should be South Dakota's next big thing.
On the east side of the state, we have cybersecurity presence and a lot of companies that are investing in that space. Here in Rapid City, the technology companies are really finding that this is a special place to be, and this can be the Silicon Prairie. This can be a place that the rest of the country is talking about as the best location to put their companies.
Construction crews expect to start work on the foundation beginning in June. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lee Strubinger in Rapid City.
Governor Kristi Noem is asking the South Dakota Athletic Commission to immediately rescind its requirement that sports participants provide proof they are vaccinated for COVID-19. In a letter to Commission Chairman Michael Kilmer, Noem wrote that requiring proof of a vaccination would eliminate South Dakotans' ability to, quote, make reasonable decisions on their own health while they participate in activities in our communities. The South Dakota Athletic Commission oversees mixed martial arts, boxing, and kickboxing within the state. Noem says her request is under the authority of her latest executive order, banning government-instituted vaccine passports. The owner of the Dakota Access Pipeline says shutting down the flow of oil would have dire financial consequences based on recent economic conditions. Texas-based Energy Transfer says a judge should deny a motion by the Standing Rock Tribe in the Dakotas and other pipeline opponents to halt the business while the U.S. Corps of Engineers conducts an extensive environmental review. The company says shuttering the pipeline would collectively result in billions of dollars in losses to various entities, including the state of North Dakota and three affiliated tribes. Meanwhile, North Dakota's attorney general filed a motion to intervene in the lawsuit, saying the Corps can no longer represent the state's interests. New numbers from the South Dakota Department of Labor and Regulation show unemployment claims are down. New claims fell to 268 last week. That's down 22 claims from the week before. Claims for continued unemployment benefits also went down from just over 3,100 to just over 3,000. Today's weather, cloudy skies west with a chance of rain this afternoon. For SDPB News, I'm John Wynn.
And I'm Steve Zwemke. Educators, historians, and some elected officials are urging South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem and the State Department of Education to keep politics and personal bias out of the process to develop a new and enhanced civics and history initiative for public K-12 schools across the state. There's a very definite divide when it comes to the issue. The legislature approved $900,000 in one-time funding earlier this year. Where does it go from here? Bart Van Cook is content director and an investigative reporter for South Dakota News Watch. He joins us for a closer look. Bart, welcome back to In the Moment.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. So the Department of Education has already started working on the South Dakota Civics and History Initiative. Give us a little background on why and then the process that this is going to go through.
Yeah, there's a healthy debate, I think a productive discussion going on right now about what this initiative can and should contain and how it will be applied in schools. The final product will be voluntary for individual school districts, and that's important to note. In a nutshell, the initiative will take about 2 years to develop fully, include enhanced teacher training in civics and history, new teaching materials that will be placed in a central depository, a review of existing social studies materials, and then the creation of pilot programs that will give individual schools and districts the chance to innovate in the classroom. The first step, as you noted, the pilot programs, the application process has already begun. You know, questions about how civics and history should be taught are always somewhat controversial. People worry about whether history will be rewritten from one perspective or another. And I think that's more acute this time around, since this proposal has come directly from Governor Kristi Noem. Noem announced the initiative in January, and the legislature, as you noted, put money toward it. Some historians and educators have told NewsWatch that they're concerned whether politics, the governor's politics in particular, could enter into the process of developing the initiative or in the resulting teaching materials. Noem's been, as you know, outspoken on civics and increasingly on social issues. She called the 2020 presidential election rigged, suggested the January 6th insurrection at the nation's capital was fueled in part by a lack of civics education, and she's made some strong remarks here recently on immigration. So there's a concern that perhaps the governor may play an outsized role, and it's not clear what role she will play in this. I think one of the concerns, Steve, is that the Department of Education has not stated or created a panel, or whether it's an individual, which is unlikely, but hasn't created a committee that will have final say over what's in the initiative. And one other thing I'll mention is the other concern is whether there'll be a fair telling of the history of Native American tribes in South Dakota, mm-hmm. whose members, as we know, over time and throughout history have been persecuted, relocated, forcefully relocated, and in some cases traumatized by state and federal government during their history. So I think that there's a good debate going on, a good discussion leading into the next steps in the process.
Yeah, you've mentioned some of the arguments from all sides of this initiative. And where does South Dakota rank in the nation in the areas of civics, history, and social studies? How do our students rank?
You know, we're not terrible. There has been a drop nationally in overall civics understanding in public schools among students that have taken standardized tests over the past few years. Things have gotten better over the past 20 years. But I talked to a number of educators and experts who said that they really feel like students are not coming to, say, the secondary education level or the college level with a strong base of how government works. And there's always national statistics out there that look kind of grim. Only 25% of people in a survey a few years back could name the three branches of government. Hmm. So those things are concerning. And this has been a long time concern in South Dakota that people understand how government works to increase participation in government, better participate in the process from a citizen level, and also understand our history better. History has taken a back seat somewhat in the classroom as the STEM efforts to increase STEM education, science, technology, math, and engineering. History has fallen off only so many hours in a day. They want to bring a greater focus back on history, and So, you know, not terrible in South Dakota among our students, but not necessarily leaders in the country either.
Yeah, Bart, we have just a few seconds left. If you could, before we go, is there a timeline on when the Department of Education will have a finalized plan? And will you already mentioned it's not necessarily policy for all school districts. They're not forced on this, but do you know what the timeline might be?
It's a two-year process overall. It's going to be these pilot programs will start soon. Funding will go out. There's a couple $100,000 out there for schools or individual teachers even to kind of create new classroom experiences. We really want to develop a situation where students are learning about history and from books and classroom teaching, but also get engaged in government, get engaged in the learning of history close up. And so about 2 years, and there's a lot still to be determined, and I think that's why this is a good discussion to have on the front end rather than coming on the back end and trying to change what's already been done.
Bart Van Cook is content director and an investigative reporter with South Dakota News Watch. Bart, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
A new venue in McLaughlin is going to help Native American youth experience life away from the reservation. SDPB's Richard Tubols brings us details next on In the Moment from South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Hi, this is Susie calling with the Vehicle Service Department.
Vehicle warranty robocalls. They're annoying, they're constant, and they have a fascinating history. On the next Planet Money, why they're blowing up your phone. And on How I Built This, we talked to Vlad Tinev, co-founder of the online stock trading platform Robinhood. That's coming up on the next Planet Money and How I Built This from NPR.
Saturday afternoon at 2 Central, 1 Mountain. On SDPB Radio.
Program funding by the Matthews Opera House and Arts Center in Spearfish. Enjoy the American Patchwork Quartet, April 29th at 7:30 p.m., featuring Grammy-nominated musicians. Ticket information at matthewsoperahouse.com/APQ.
Eric Andre is out with a new movie called Bad Trip. It's full of elaborate pranks played on real people. But Eric says, don't see them as the butt of a joke.
It's a black cast in compromised situation, and it was just nice seeing black people help black people out.
Eric Andre and Pranking While Black. Next time on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
Saturday afternoon at 3 Central, 2 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding is provided by Gene Hufford of American Family Insurance on Jackson Boulevard in Rapid City. Gene and his team of experienced insurance advisors will insure your home with your specific needs and budget in mind. GeneHufford.com.
Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Steve Zwemke and for Lori Walsh today. The Lakota People's Law Project was founded in the early 2000s with the main intent of keeping Lakota children safe and in Native American care. Today, they're maintaining that vision as they're in the process of purchasing a building in McLaughlin, South Dakota, with the intent of converting it into a teen center. The teen center would give youth in the area not only a place to go, but will provide unique cultural and real-life teaching opportunities. SDPB's Richard Tubols recently interviewed a McLaughlin City Council member who often works in conjunction with the Lakota People's Law Project. Richard, welcome back.
Hi, Steve. Always a pleasure, man. Thanks for having me. You know, so the Lakota People's Law Project was founded in 2004. And at that moment, its core purpose was to investigate and help prevent the South Dakota Department of Social Services from removing Native American children from their families. And what typically happened was they placed them in foster care that consisted of non-Native families and other facilities. But that was a direct violation of the Indian Child Welfare Act. But not only do they do that, though, they also focus on other social issues such as, Native voting rights, securing treaty lands, and defending the water rights, just to name a few.
Yeah, and the good thing is they haven't lost sight of one of their original goals of protecting Native American youth. They're currently working on establishing a teen center. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, they're currently in the works of purchasing a building in McLaughlin, South Dakota, like you said earlier. So, you know, it's one of the largest towns in the Standing Rock Reservation. I was able to talk with McLaughlin City Council member Hoke Sheila Whitemountain about the project, and he's excited for the opportunities it gives the youth.
Right now, we're in the works of developing the actual title. we're consulting some elders and some local community members to try to figure out what kind of words we, that could be described as probably as like a life skills, you know, and that's kind of what we want to teach in this teen center. We're going to kind of mix the two with life skills and culture, if that makes sense. So we're kind of planning on in the beginning of the day where the students come in, we'll circle up, we'll have a talking circle type where we smudge, maybe sing a song, you know what I mean? Get everybody kind of centered of where we at, where we came from in school. And probably even if it ain't like a school day, just a regular day, just kind of like have a day, a moment where we kind of get the kids together to try to, I guess, just gather ourselves, you know what I mean? And be able to share.
You know, what's interesting, Steve, is like one of those life skills that they want these youth to embrace. And it's one of those that we all go through when we go to college or we leave the nest is simply learning how to cook.
We want to have it to where not only are we helping them with the meals at home, but maybe sending them home with a little bit of supplies so they knew like, hey, we, you can make this at home too if you later on in the week for your family too as well. You know, that's kind of one of the goals. But in the beginning part, during dinner time, we'll sit down and we'll cook with them and then kind of teach them the whole thing about cooking and stuff, because we realize that some of these kids don't really have like the day-to-day life skills, how to cook necessarily, how to clean, take care of a home.
One of the goals, I understand, Richard, is to be able to help these young adults in regards to doing real-world things, such as writing resumes or even filling out applications.
Yeah, Steve, I don't know. Like, one of those things that I grew up with is I didn't, you know, a lot of those I had to learn on my own. And I think preparing these young adults for their future, you know, with resumes, job, and college applications, and basically, you know, they're instilling in them the confidence to further their educational or professional careers.
Even as far as like the references, and you know, kids can kind of panic, and even some young adults and grown adults panic whenever they think of the idea of doing a resume, you know, but it really is just a chronological work order of where you've worked and what you've done in your life. And sometimes people don't really acknowledge the fact or know that they can use those life skills that they've learned, whether it be on a ranch with an uncle or, you know what I mean, working with their dad at some things. So we want to teach these kids to actually kind of help, you know, sell themselves, you know, to be able to have better opportunities, but not only sell themselves, but show them that they have these skills and these are things that they've learned and that this can help them whenever they go out there, that they're not just entering out into this world alone.
Richard, one of the things I find really interesting is a goal of the Teen Center is to provide teens with the opportunity to experience life in urban areas outside the reservation.
Yeah, you know what, Steve, what's funny about that is, you know, I grew up kind of all over in my background, but I didn't fly in a plane until I was 16. And I know a lot of people don't really have that experience at all sometimes, but it really opened my eyes. I went to visit my uncle and his family in Los Angeles. And when I had to go back to South Dakota, I was a little bummed out because I was like, oh, Los Angeles is so cool. But, you know, some of our Native American youth in these reservations in our state, there are some that even haven't even left the reservation borders.
Yeah. Well, the Teen Center sounds like it'll be an amazing resource once it gets up and running. Is there anything else you'd like to tell us about it?
Yeah, I think right now they're still in the process of securing a building. But, you know, when they get started with their outreach, I think it'll be a wonderful resource for the youth. You know, I grew up on many reservations in my background, and I wish there were options like this for me when I was growing up. And I know it's very easy to fall through the cracks, whether it's because of family issues, social issues, or even educational issues, you know. But the thing I like about this place is that it'll teach these kids, teach them to have that Lakota pride in their culture, but it'll also cultivate real life skills for them to be successful.
I would like to be able to see these children be able to go out there with the pride of like, it's good. I'm a good, you know, to have that sense of high self-esteem, to be able to feel that they deserve that nice apartment, that they deserve to have a good job, that they deserve it because they have the skills, that they're able to do it, you know, and they're just as intelligent as anybody else that lived off the reservation. Or, you know, geographical, where you grew up geographical does not really hinder you, and it doesn't really compute on your intelligence or where you're able to be later on in life.
Steve, currently they're still working on securing a location, but, you know, like Sheila said earlier, they're trying to develop a name that for the teen center that would translate the words life skills into Lakota. And, you know, Lakota, there's a lot of words that have a lot of different meanings based on context. But if there are any fluent Lakota speakers listening, feel free to reach out to Lakota People's Law Project. You know, maybe we can get them have a really cool name, I guess.
It's really fun to hear about this. Richard Tubols is a diversity reporter for South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Richard, thank you for bringing details of this project to today's show.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Up next, a look at 1 year of COVID-19 through the eyes of people all over the world. Frontline Director James Blumel is with us after the break. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB Radio.
The guilty verdict applied only to the former Minneapolis police officer who killed George Floyd. But for Black Americans across the country, a whole lot more was unofficially on trial.
Uncomfortable.
Different.
Traumatic.
Hopeful for change. Or just hopeful.
I'm Ari Shapiro. Black Americans react to the conclusion of the Derek Chauvin trial this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain on SDPB.
Multi-level marketing companies peddling things like vitamins or essential oils recruit millions of sellers, but most don't turn a profit unless they are at the very top of all those multi-levels.
I was the only person that was reaping the success, and nobody else was.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, leaving your MLM behind next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30 Central, 5:30 Mountain on SDPB Radio.
As news cycles spin more furiously, the stories of our everyday lives and local traditions can get lost. SDPB prioritizes South Dakotans' daily realities by building community one story at a time. Your gift to the Sound Vision campaign supports crucial, trustworthy news, and you also help SDPB chronicle how we live and what we care about. So consider a gift. Visit sdpb.org/soundvision.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB Radio. I'm Steve Zwemke. We just recently passed the one-year mark of the coronavirus in the United States. Other parts of the world have dealt with it even longer. In a special two-night premiere next Monday and Tuesday, SDPB TV will air the new frontline documentary, The Virus That Shook the World. It's an in-depth look at what it's been like for people around the globe to live through the year of the pandemic, from lockdowns to funerals to protests. The Virus That Shook the World examines how people and countries responded to the virus across cultures, race, faith, and privilege. British Academy of Film and Television Arts Award-winning director James Blumel is behind the new two-part Frontline, which premieres Monday night at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, with Part 2 premiering Tuesday night at 9 Central, 8 Mountain. It's also available to stream on Frontline's website, YouTube, and the PBS video app. James Blumel, welcome to In the Moment.
Hey, thank you very much.
Great to have you with us. The virus that shook the world is described as the story of the first year of the pandemic seen through the eyes of people from all over the world. James, it would normally be a dream to travel the world, but not under these circumstances. Your team worked through lockdowns, fear, riots, death. How did your team persevere through this assignment?
I mean, normally you're right. We would travel the world and as a documentary filmmaker, you go to the places and film the story. And the restrictions of lockdown meant that couldn't happen. And one of the, one of the weird benefits, one of the good things to come out of lockdown, I suppose, was sort of reaching out to local filmmakers across the world to say, listen, can you film, your filmmakers, you live in Colombia, can you film what's going on in your country? And just forming these contacts in this community was how we made the film, through sort of reaching out to local filmmakers and getting them to film their own stories. And it was one of the really lovely things to come out of lockdown. It was meeting this community out there.
That's remarkable. It's like a networking project like never seen before.
Yeah, and it's kind of, the arrogance in a certain way. I mean, in a certain way, the arrogance that you think that, as a British person, I'm going to go to Colombia and make the film. Maybe I'm going to reassess that arrogance a little bit, and maybe going forward in the future, I'm going to carry on building this sort of network of filmmakers from around the world. I think it's a good way to proceed.
It kind of ties in with my next question, because I wanted to ask you about what the pandemic has done to unite people around the world. Obviously, it's united some filmmakers from around the world, but what about just, us as regular people?
Well, I suppose as regular people, we've realized that we are vulnerable to something which we all thought was happening miles away at the beginning in China. Like, no one really, really thought it was going to affect us when we saw the news. And I guess that's been a wake-up call for all of us, that we are all vulnerable in this world. I mean, perhaps the world is smaller than we thought. The virus got to all. I mean, it's gone everywhere. In the film, you see it reaches tiny little village in the western fjords of far, far north Iceland, of all places. So, and I suppose that shared experience has united us to some extent. And I think the other surprising thing for me is how much it's divided us.
Yeah, I wanted to go to that next. What's divided us, as your team gained information and footage for the virus that shook the world, what were some of the places, and maybe even who were some of the voices that spoke loudly enough to divide us or even put us in danger?
Well, I suppose at the beginning, it was probably government policies. And, one country is, like for us in Britain, we were looking at India sort of going, poor Italians, they've got it really bad, and carrying on as normal, And as the pandemic took hold across the world, I think countries' reactions sort of were the first cause of division. How some countries prioritized economy over health. And at the beginning, more people thought that was the right idea. And then as things go on, there's a tension between that ratio. Is it worth sacrificing all this to lockdown? I mean, I think, yes, probably. But there's a balance there. And I think when those divisions about how we live start to sort of seep in, it escalated phenomenally quickly. It suddenly after a few months of lockdown and people sort of being cooped up and relatively pulling together, I think. I mean, I'm talking really now from the sort of perspective of the people sort of I filmed with. And there was a sense of solidarity that we are going to try and get through this. But after months of it, I think you saw cracks appearing in societies across the world pretty quickly. And it's no coincidence, I think, that over that course of the summer last year, riots were kicking off in America, in Serbia, in Latin America, in Britain, in Berlin. It suddenly just erupted, and all at the same time. And I wonder if we can't, we probably shouldn't ignore the fact that that's not a coincidence. Yeah. That's something to do with the pressure cooker that we were living in.
James Blumell is our guest. He's director of The Virus That Shook the World, a new Frontline documentary premiering Monday and Tuesday. You can see it on SDPB-TV. You had to have had thousands of personal stories to choose from for this documentary. How are you able to choose from all of them as you stitched this project together?
It was nuts. Not normally when you sort of cast for a documentary, you have your pool isn't as big as the entire world. and that's what I was sort of looking at. And I was trying to find places which would, I was thinking that, well, look, I think there's lots of documentaries that are going to be made about the health crisis. They're going to hit that one head on. So I don't want to embed in hospitals massively. And I don't want to make, a really long documentary full of people who are ill. I'm trying to look for the secondary effects of this virus. And I was trying to do that quite early on, and that took a little bit of prediction, you know, about what might happen. So I was trying to find people that would be engaging and charismatic and interesting to be with, that were in interesting situations, which, you know, if you gamble on them early and film with them, things will happen. And that's what I was looking for, you know. And you know, people that would give contrast, not just geographical contrast, but contrast in how they navigate this pandemic. So, you know, it's across the whole spectrum of geographical, spinning the globe, and as well as sort of economic. You know, you've got sort of very, very poor people that live in, that I filmed with in Delhi, can, you know, and then you can spin the globe and land it with a prima ballerina in Russia.
I enjoyed that. Yeah.
Yeah. And that sort of, it was trying to show the enormity and the scale, the diversity of everyone that's affected.
James, could I ask you to share a personal story? Maybe it's one of the people we meet in the film, or maybe it's something totally separate from that. A personal story that remains poignant to you during the process of making this film, putting it together.
The one I'm going to tell you about is because it's so relevant today. What's today? 23rd of April. So I filmed with a guy in Delhi called Prakash. He's a musician. He's a wedding musician. That's how he makes his money. He lives in a poor neighborhood. You know, it's a slum neighborhood, and like everyone, he was very, very worried about the virus, and his livelihood was taken away. He doesn't have any money in the bank. You know, when the wedding was stopped, there's nothing for him to do. He can't earn money. He is facing starvation. So he was very, very stressed about that situation he found himself in. And as I followed him for the months, you could see that he was beginning to question, what are we doing? Why am I doing this? Why am I putting my family through this? Why are my kids not eating properly? This is crazy. What is this virus anyway? He's looking around. He doesn't see his community coming down with it. And he begins to, you know, he begins to rebel against these measures, and he doesn't want to wear the mask. He doesn't want a social distance. He wants to get back together. He wants to earn money. He wants gatherings to happen. He wants weddings to happen. And I kind of felt for Prakash. I really sort of felt for his predicament. And I haven't spoken to him today, but I was listening to the news today about how bad it is now in Delhi. And I feel very worried, because I'm not sure that, that attitude right now in Delhi is going to serve him well. But
yeah, thank you for sharing that story. It's a situation many of us can probably identify with as well. James, we have just about a minute left, but I wanted to bring this up as well. You know, so much has changed over the last year, the way we work, the way we worship, the way we eat, the way we communicate. Do we ever get back to where the normals were, or have those permanently changed?
Well, I mean, I'm no expert, but I imagine is that we snap back. People get used to things, but I don't think COVID's going anywhere. I think we are going to have COVID in our lives and in our children's lives and probably in our grandchildren's lives. It's here. We're going to live with it. We're not going to keep. It's not going to beat us again, I don't think. But it's something we've got to manage now for a long time to come.
The Virus That Shook the World premieres Monday night at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, with Part 2 premiering Tuesday at 9 Central, 8 Mountain. It's also available to stream on Frontline's website, YouTube, and the PBS video app. It's directed by James Blumel. James, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thanks for inviting me on. Thank you.
In April, SDPB is spotlighting guns in South Dakota. We're talking policy and politics, hunting and heritage, fear, and fascination. We're also inviting you to share your stories with your friends and family and with us. More on that in just a moment. First, SDPB's Chris Loffrey tells about one of his formative memories. Here's a little background. Chris was 9 years old when the story you're about to hear unfolded. He lived in an urban, working-class neighborhood outside of Chicago Heights, Illinois, with his adoptive mother and father. As a kid, he liked to play street football in the neighborhood. His dad kept guns in the house, which never seemed like a big deal. But one day, when Chris's parents were away, some older boys knocked on his door.
I don't know why I let them in the house that day. My mom and dad had a bedroom in the basement, and that's where they went. We went. And the two older boys, one was 16, 17, the other one was probably 13, 14, somewhere in there, much older than me, found a .22 rifle. I could tell it was unloaded. So I'm like, this is okay. It's unloaded. It's fine. Well, they continued to rifle through this bedroom because in their mind, where there's a gun, there's a clip. Sure enough, they found the clip or what have you for this .22 rifle, and they loaded it. So I said, what do we do now? We're going to shoot it. I'm going to say they took the first few shots, live rounds, out the back door of our house. And there's people behind us.
What are they aiming at?
I have no idea what they're aiming at. I don't think they know what they're aiming at.
They're just shooting.
Yeah. So I shoot a couple times. I think I hit the shed. My guess is I probably hit the ground. That created a big ruckus. There's gunfire in a city small like that. And guess who arrives? The city police. And guess who's standing there holding this rifle? Me.
Where are the teenage boys?
They took off. The next thing I remember is being in the back seat of that police car by myself, hunched over so nobody could see me. Because I didn't want that. Because that wasn't who I was. But the worst part was facing reality, looking up, and all my friends are looking at me through these windows of this police car. We get down to the police precinct, and they put me in a holding cell. They don't close the door at this point. They're on a speakerphone with my mother. Oh, I heard my mother on speaker going, close the door, leave him there. And I was like, what? Goosebumps to this day. I just got them. Hearing my mother say that. And then, the next sound I heard? That door closing. I felt really bad because guess who had to go to court? I didn't. My dad went to court over this. And what hurts the most is he had to surrender every weapon he had, everything. And they melted them down, gone. Well, I think it impacts me the most that we never want to disappoint, And I feel like that was one big point in my life where I extremely disappointed both of them. And I can't have it back. It's tough. If I have any message to anybody at all, it's please take care of your weapons. I'm not against them. But do the right thing and don't let what happened to me happen to you.
That's SDPB's Chris Loffrey telling about one of his formative memories about guns. We want to hear your story. Call us at 605-951-0740. That's 605-951-0740. You can find all our spotlight coverage on our website, sdpb.org/guns.
This week on Science Friday, as states battle to limit transgender rights, how trans children blossom under gender-affirming care.
Really, gender-affirming care allows children to be children and to blossom. It's really liberating for many young people.
Plus the White House Climate Summit and plans to position wind turbines off the New England coast. It's all on Science.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain.
I'm Carl Gerke, and this evening on Jazz Nightly, we'll hear tracks from the Jeff Benedict Big Big Band, drummer Dave Weckl, and trombonist Clifton Anderson. Plus, we'll have a radical reworking of some Thelonious Monk by saxophonist Dan Willis and Velvet Gentleman. And we'll hear some classic tracks from Dizzy Gillespie and Stan Getz. You can tune in at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, right here on SDPB Radio.
South Dakota's finest high school band students gather at the Mitchell High School Performing Arts Center for the South Dakota All-State Band Concert. SDPB brings you the sights and sounds. Friday, April 23rd at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on SDPB.
Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Steve Swemke. You and Your Democracy is a series of short-take civics lessons hosted by Chuck Parkinson. You can find the full series online at sdpb.org/yourdemocracy. In today's episode, Chuck visits with Wes Brown, the South Dakota State Coordinator at Vantage Institute, to discuss the separation of powers within our government.
Well, I think it's interesting. I want to back up just a little bit. You know, that whole idea of separation of powers is, you know, is only like, 300 years old, 200 years, you know, the 1700s with Montesquieu, when he wrote Spirits of Law, he really kind of laid out this whole idea of having three branches, a legislative, an executive, and a judicial branch. So the founding fathers, James Madison, when he was writing the Constitution, you know, he really looked at that in the original text, actually. So I thought that was always interesting.
Yeah, historically, where things are drawn from always are that important. It was such a change, you know, democracies and pure democracies that existed through the centuries. But this experiment with the three branches was a totally, you know, totally new game, a plan.
Yeah, it really is. And I think if we just look at them real briefly, you know, I mentioned them kind of on this on the level is, you know, we have three branches of government, the legislative branch that is established under the Constitution under Article 1, is responsible for enacting the laws and appropriating the monies necessary to operate the government. I think that's very important, and we'll probably come back to that. The second branch is the executive branch under Article 2 of the Constitution, who is responsible for implementing and administering the public policy enacted and funded by the legislative branch. And then finally, the judicial branch under Article 3 of the Constitution is responsible for interpreting the Constitution and laws and applying their interpretations to controversies brought before it. That's just kind of in a nutshell, and I think it's a really cool concept, the whole idea of checks and balances.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that people do forget is the fact is that, you know, having served in both on professional staff of the legislative branch and in the executive, I guess being the institutionalist that I am, I have a bias toward the legislative side of the house because it was created, as you said, by Article 1, and all powers of Congress come from the people. The people directly elect the members of Congress to be responsible to them and responsible to how they spend our tax money.
That's right. And that's the most important thing, I think, is the oversight of our budget. You know, if there was any oversight, you could just have corruption just run rampant.
So, I think, and that's been pointed out several times about the fact about how important oversight is and the fact of asking the questions of how and where is the executive branch spending the money that we directly told you how it should be spent. And there are procedures which hopefully we'll address in a future program about how that works and how it can be flexible. But for the most part, as Article 1, Section 9 directly says, no money can be spent without the direct appropriation of the Congress.
Right. And he's mandated to spend it unless otherwise stated. Isn't that correct?
That is correct. That is correct. And there have been a number of things through the years, a number of laws enacted to do that. And there was one in 1974, the Budget Control and Impoundment Act, was a direct result of Richard Nixon refusing to spend money that had been appropriated for Congress. And so they amended the law that existed to, you know, basically say, you know, this is the way the money is. People want to spend the money and go ahead and do that. Now, the president does have, and this gets really in the weeds, he can ask for, you know, to rescind certain monies and reappropriate them that way. But that takes a congressional action. That's not a unilateral action by the president.
Right. And the legislature can actually appropriate money for for some law or some policies and stuff to be put and then not spend that money. So they have that power where they can kind of pull back or hold back some money, even though they've already previously allocated it.
That is correct. That is correct, is that there are those procedures available and Congress can take steps to make sure that that does not happen. And I think one of the questions is we need to ask why. You know, you touched on oversight, which is the mere, not only enacting laws, but to enact good laws, good oversight is the mandatory underwriting of that. You know, a lot of people can come up with ideas for laws, but to actually, you know, have the oversight to figure out how to do that is in what you want to do is the really important step.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, kind of moving away from that, if we could, I want to talk briefly about the Supreme Court because, and then we can come back is that all right, Chuck?
Well, yeah, I think each one of the branches is several programs, quite
yeah.
frankly. And we could, you know, in the short take, we don't have a lot of time to dwell on any.
Right. And we probably don't, you know, and I know the clock is ticking. So, you know, we've not always had nine justices. Early on, we had six originally, and then 1869 established the number of nine. I know, you know, there's discussion about stacking the court. Roosevelt tried it and wasn't successful. But one thing that is, I think, is very important that we understand about the Supreme Court, and that's judicial review. And that was actually established by John Marshall, the fourth Chief Justice. It's not in the Constitution, but he established it basically with the fight between Mulberry versus Madison and the midnight appointments of Adams and then Jefferson not signing the commissions. And Mulberry fought it and he won ultimately, but he had died before he was even able to get his commission. But I think if you're not going to read anything about the Supreme Court, that's one case everybody should be forced to read because it really laid the groundwork for the Supreme Court.
It did. It outlined the role of the court and what the, you know, emanated from the court. It's important to look back and see what the actual role of the court is.
Right. And I think there's a lot of, maybe fear is the wrong word, fear about now stacking. It's, you know, it's Congress who sets the number of justices. Could it happen? Yes. Will it happen? Probably not, because, you know, it would take an act of Congress to do it. And I don't think there's the mustard for that. But.
Yeah, it proved in the Roosevelt administration when there was an overwhelming Democratic Congress and they stepped up and said not to that. Let's take a step back for a moment.
Sure.
And we talk a little bit of each of the three. What would happen if those were all melded together?
I've never even thought about melding them all together, what that would look like, other than tyranny, maybe. And that's what I'm afraid of.
Right. Well, that goes back to a lot of comments that Madison made early on about the very importance of keeping the three branches of government, because if they slipped into one or, you know, certain people got together to do that, tyranny would result at that particular point, because you would have a monarchy again.
Yeah. Yeah. And see, what's also interesting, and I think it's Federalist 68, Publius, who they think it may have been Hamilton at this point, was talking about, you know, when they were looking at a president, the virtues of a president. And they really thought, and part of the Electoral College was developed for this, is everybody in their local states would identify somebody that is the sage and smarter and more ethical than anybody else. And those people would rise to the top. And there was a push to not have political parties. So it's interesting to see what, you know, what the original founding fathers wanted, but then what really has established, even right, almost right away with Adams and Jefferson with political parties.
Exactly. And it, you know, calls back to the fact in George Washington's farewell speech, he said, beware of those political parties. They do not have your best interests, to paraphrase, your best interests in mind at this particular, only theirs from that standpoint.
Right. And I think we were very fortunate to have a president like Washington, because he was kind of the sage and he stepped down on his own. There was talk about having him as a monarch, you know, in some circles. So I think we were very lucky to have Washington to really set the expectations of a president.
Yeah, it goes back to the idea of people of virtue holding office and
yes.
honor. And the fact is that they reported directly to the people, because the people were responsible for putting them there.
You and Your Democracy is a series of short takes civics lessons hosted by Chuck Parkinson. You can find the full series online at sdpb.org/yourdemocracy. The Levitt in Your Living Room series continues tomorrow with the Gullah band Ranky Tanky out of South Carolina. What is Gullah music? Who are Ranky Tanky? And how can you enjoy their performance? Well, Roseanne Hofflin joins me. She's the Director of Communications and Community Engagement for Levitt at the Falls. Roseanne, it's always a delight to visit with you. Welcome back to In the Moment.
Thank you, Steve. Happy to be here.
Well, good to have you. Let's begin by how you can watch this performance.
Absolutely. Well, Levitt in Your Living Room is being offered in partnership with South Dakota Public Broadcasting. So there are a few different ways that you can watch the performance. If you're a user of Facebook, you can tune in to Levitt Sioux Falls Facebook page. We'll be going live tomorrow night, so Saturday, April 24th at 7 o'clock on the Levitt Sioux Falls Facebook page. But then as a part of SDPB, you can also check it out on sdpb.net.
Perfect. Tell me, first of all, about the gregarious host of the program, Apollonia.
Yes. Well, Apollonia is a student here at the University of Sioux Falls, and she is also a filmmaker and just has the most just wonderful personality, an infectious smile, and has been a real delight for our guests of Levitt in Your Living Room to be welcomed so warmly by her.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope folks tune in to meet her, because she's just a person that you will want to know.
Very charming. She interacts so well with the members of the bands. We were talking about Gullah music. Can you explain a little bit about Gullah music? Ranky Tanky is from South Carolina, and they're pretty much right now, they are like the epicenter of Gullah music.
Yeah, they are a really wonderful and unique band. So Gullah is a cultural tradition of the southeastern United States. So the African Americans in South Carolina, Georgia, and Florida are a part of the Gullah tradition and culture, or many of them are. And so it's a long-standing tradition which brings with it music and arts and cooking and all of the things that we sort of, you know, culturally cherish. And the Gullah music has a lot of the influence of West African and Central African music, as well as music that I would say is very centered in the beautiful sounds of the Black church, so mm-hmm. spirituals and gospels, and with also this beautiful influence of jazz. All of Ranky Tanky are very skilled and trained musicians and teachers and composers, and so they bring a modern take to this rich cultural tradition, and it's really soulful and joyful and just beautiful and a good time.
That's a great description. I'd like to play a clip right now, Roseanne. This features Kiana Parler, and Kiana is an incredible vocalist. And this is a piece with just some percussion behind her. But this is called Been in the... We'll come back in just a minute, but this is a piece called Been in the Storm, which features Kiana Parler.
I've been in the storm so long. You know that I've been in the storm.
That's a very small example of Kiana's vocal skills, but she is dynamic. She is so much fun. And this is not the first time Ranky Tanky's been to South Dakota. Well, they're not coming now. They're part of In Your Living Room. But people are definitely going to love her performance, aren't they?
Oh, I think so. I mean, you can even just tell from that short clip, their music is incredibly moving. And I think after the year that we've all had, we couldn't be more excited to welcome them to Levitt in your living room tomorrow, but then also to be our opening night at the Levitt when we're all together again on the lawn.
See, I wanted so badly, after listening to her, I wanted so badly for them to be here. Well, that's good news. Now, while we touch on that, Roseanne, there's news coming up next week. Maybe you want to just give us a little teaser, but Nancy Halverson will be with us from Levitt at the Falls. And if you want to kind of tease what we're going to talk about next Thursday on the program, please go ahead.
Absolutely. So next Thursday, we will release our entire 2021 summer concert season. So that will be the 40 free concerts that will be happening in downtown Sioux Falls at the Levitt Shell. And so the big announcement is next Thursday, and you can hear about it from Nancy here on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. And then you can set your schedule, go to our website, Levitt Sioux Falls, and you'll be able to see all of the 40 different acts that will be here. And Nancy will give a brief overview, but we're very excited about the variety this year and the quality of the artists that you're going to hear on the stage.
It was something that was really missed in our culture here in Sioux Falls over the last year, wasn't it?
Yes, we desperately missed being on the lawn. We were able to continue our mission through, you know, digital offerings through Levitt in Your Living Room and then some smaller neighborhood events. But being able to just experience the energy of the lawn back to life will be a very special experience this summer.
Now, let me get back in our remaining minute here or so to talk about Levitt in Your Living Room. Can you tell us a little more about the series, what may be coming up in the future?
Absolutely. So tomorrow night we have Ranky Tanky, and then next month we're going to feature one of our other Levitt artists, so another sort of sneak preview of what's going to be coming this summer. We have a hip-hop artist from Minneapolis. His name is Matt Allen. His stage name is Nerd D, N-U-R-D, and he is going to be bringing just, again, a fun and different perspective to Levitt in Your Living Room next month. So I hope folks are able to tune in.
Oh, very well. Roseanne Hoffman, thank you so much. I can't wait for all of this to come up. More Levitt in Your Living Room. Live concerts with Levitt at the Falls. Roseanne Hoffland is the Director of Communications and Community Engagement for Levitt at the Falls. And again, catch Ranky Tanky tomorrow. It's part of Levitt in Your Living Room. Roseanne, thanks again.
Thank you, Steve.
And that'll do it for today's program. I'd like to thank Chris Loffery for producing today's show. Also, thank you to Lori Walsh and Richard Tuples at SDPB. Keep in mind, Dr. Shankar Kura of Monument Health is with us on Monday for our weekly COVID-19 update. I'm Steve Zwemke. For all of us at South Dakota Public Broadcasting, thanks for listening and have a great weekend.